It's Wednesday, September 24th, 2008, and you're listening to episode 116 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 1 hour and 8 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Chad.
I'm Pat.
And Chris is old.
Happy birthday. How old are you? 60 now?
I am close, very close. And in gamer years, I would be 60. No, I'm I turned 40 on the 15th.
Wow.
Yay, somebody's finally older than me.
I'm part of that. I've moved into that generation of gamers that I look back at 20 years ago saying, I wonder if people really play games when they're like 40.
So, Chris, what's it like being a fat beard?
He's beardless and skinny,
but he's old.
Okay.
I'm one of those guys where the belt, you tighten the belt enough where it loops around back around to the front. You know, I'm that kind of old gamer. That's what.
Now, Chris, now that you're 40,
yes,
and you're fairly well established in life, do you ever see yourself coming to a point to where you will stop gaming?
You know, that's a very good question, and I have actually thought about that. You know, will there ever be a time when I'll just look at the books on my shelf and go, really? No. But, I have to say the answer, honestly, is probably not. I don't think I ever could. I don't think I ever could stop. It would be, there might be some time in the future where it becomes very odd, you know, where I'm sitting at a table filled with 20-year-olds, you know, sometime way down the road. But I don't think I could. I enjoy it too much, and even though I'm currently in a gaming dry spell, so to speak, I don't think I could ever end that.
I have this friend named Skip, and he I haven't actually talked to him in a long time, but
great friend.
I have this really good friend, and I wish I could remember what his name was.
Yeah, I feel real bad about not talking to him, but you know that's just how life goes sometimes.
Absolutely,
people come and people go sometimes. But, he is, I want to say 65-ish. He was in the Vietnam War. He was drafted in the Vietnam War, and he has been playing role playing games since the 1980s. And his story was that him and his son, when his son was really young, were looking for something to do together. And so they walked into like a B. Dalton or bookstore of some kind and were just walking around. It's like, man, we want to do something together. You know, what can we do together? Let's, you know, we're looking at, I guess they were looking at books on like woodworking and auto repair and that sort of thing. What's something we can do together? And then they saw this D&D, right? This D&D box or books, or I don't know what version he had, probably something with a big old dragon and knight on it. And they're like, wow, that is so cool.
Yes, I'd wager it's probably this version right here.
The big red thing with the red dragon and the Conan.
The big
dude.
Red box. Right on.
And and then they grabbed it and started playing it. Never had heard of it at all before that. Never had any contact with it at all. And he is like 65 years old. He is still playing to this day with his son and the group that they had made.
It just comes down to one basic question. Is role-playing an immature hobby?
No.
And if it's not...
According to my mom, yes.
Well,
but,
you know, according to those of us that do it, I don't think it is. And that being the case, if it's not something I have felt the need to outgrow by 20, by 30, in Chris's case, by 60, then why give it up thereafter?
Is baseball a kid's game?
Yeah.
I mean,
precisely.
You know,
exactly.
No, it's not.
I think it's a, you know, role-playing itself is a new enough entity. And by that, I mean, it's been around for, like you said, 20, 30-ish
40
years
or
so. That, I mean, it's not like baseball. It's been around forever. Some of these older, really ingrained sports. So sort of you're still in your first few generations of people that are playing it. So it is just evolving. And I agree. I think I'll be role playing as long as I live.
Yeah.
You know, I think the important thing of it.
There's really no difference between the stories that you would create around the table with your, say, you know, to go by your example, Chad, with your children, than any other stories that you would create in family experiences and stuff that, you know, 15 years down the road when you're having that little family reunion and you can talk and, you know, go back and forth with your kids about, do you remember when we went into this castle and blah, blah, blah?
Well,
and it's,
you know,
just
what?
As fond of a memory.
People have been gathering around in groups and telling each other stories since the dawn of time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and to think that role-playing games are somehow different than that, yeah, the trappings are different. We have rules and structure, and we have some dice, and there's no campfire with a big spit of meat on it. But
That would be cool, though.
But it would be good.
I would wholly support that myself. But, you know, it's just a different kind of storytelling.
I would even say that role-playing, you could compare it to, like, even to, like, music, and just mm-hmm. that different people like different types of music. And as you get older, your music tastes change. Yeah. Or more, what it is that your music, you know, you listen to the music you listen to. So
right.
now the younger kids, they look...
You've gone from that crazy rock stuff, which is all combat and dungeon crawls, yeah. to something more refined, which is, you know, Battletech. But to
hip-hop of darkness.
But, you know, the, like, yes. you know, in 10, 20 years from now, like, the new role-playing games may not appeal to, like,
right.
us as gamers of this age.
Yeah.
Maybe, who knows? Maybe they
you
will.
Know, but, you I'm know. Really interested, though, in like, when you're really, not, well, not you, Chris, but just in general, when you're really, really old, are you in a nursing home? Are there people in nursing homes who sit around and, like, role play? Although I think that's the wrong generation.
Well, I think
it's going to happen.
I think it will. Yeah. Right.
I think it will happen. It's,
you're not going to see it right now just because it hasn't been around.
I mean, as long as you're cognitively there.
Uh-huh. Several episodes ago, I made some passing joke about opening a nursing home that was designed for role players of the, you know, that generation that's headed that towards that age.
Right.
And, you know, of course it was all in jest, but it really actually did get a small amount of interest. Yeah. And
mm-hmm. nothing you can open a nursing home on.
Well, nothing. I don't even care to run a nursing yeah, home personally.
You know what? If it's not a nursing home, it should be, because really, I mean, you could, and we don't want to get too far into this, but you could make the argument of the mental stimulation that's involved in doing this kind of stuff, you know, not to mention the math computation, all of those things, which are great mental exercises to do at any age.
The same reason they're now putting Wii's in all the nursing homes for the physical stimulation.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Speaking of all the different generations learning about role-playing games, all the tutorials we did in episode 115, chapters 1-7, will now be compiled into a CD that you can purchase from Cafe Press. It's still, I believe, going to be $5. We will cut some of the intro and outro music off of each of the tracks to make this play as friendly as possible.
Right. No, copyright info after every single chapter.
It'll maybe be a final track or something. But if you're interested in getting that, go and check that out. And also, for anyone that listened to chapter 2 right as it dropped, based on some user comments, I actually went back and added in about another 90 seconds to that episode.
What'd you add into it?
Well, what I added in was there were some people that commented that we didn't really define the exact phrase role-playing game, what it means to have a game where you play a role. And so I added in about 90 seconds of just trying to explain what the phrase means.
That's cool.
So if you're interested in checking that out, feel free to grab it. If you, once again, you don't want to buy it, that's perfectly fine. We just want to sell a hobby, not sell CDs.
Right.
So
we're going to
do whatever you please.
That Cafe Press thing, we are going to select whatever options we can to make it not give us any money, basically to make it as cheap as possible as they will allow it to be.
Worldwide Wing Night 5 coming up here.
Oh, yeah.
Don't forget that. I believe it is on Saturday, November, is it 18th?
I don't know.
I don't.
You're excited about it. You just don't know what it is.
Well, I tell you what, I will link it in the show notes. If the show notes know better than I do. So
yes.
I will link it in the show notes. Be sure to check that date. Come out here on that Saturday and hang with us. And if you are interested, the Backseat Producers, the podcast about movies that is run by Professor Tony Mast.
Yes, the pimp of the internet.
Does pimp do internet?
He is going to be doing something with the folks from his show earlier in the day that he kind of wants to tie into our event, where it's going to be something like the Backseat Producers see a porno or...
Yeah, because there's that. Oh, well, don't get too excited, Pat.
Yeah.
It's that movie.
The Kevin Smith movie.
So-and-so make a porno.
Yeah, two guys make a porno. I forget the name.
No, Zach and Miri. Zach and Miri make a porno.
Oh, okay. It's hetero porn. Yeah. Thank you.
All right,
Seth Rogen, Elizabeth Banks, I believe.
All right. Well, what they're going to do is they're going to go see that movie earlier in the day and then roll straight into the Worldwide Wing Night. So I don't personally have any info to give you on that, but I want to make you aware of that. And as I get info from Tony confirming that and giving times, I'll pass that along if you're interested in doing that. Last but not least, a little while back here, we tried an Age of Conan guild.
Wah, wah, wah.
Yeah, and our WoW guild we did, you know, 2 years ago or a year ago or whatever was a smashing success. The Age of Conan Guild, not so much, mostly because we just really didn't get that many people that played the game.
Well, but it was one of those things that the game itself fell rather short of expectations.
And promises.
Yeah, you know, I don't want to get too into it, because actually I could fill up a whole show on bitches on it, but which we did and we threw out because we were just doing nothing but bitching about it, and then they changed the game on us. But anyway, I digress. Pretty much what happened was the game fell short of expectations. Everybody jumped on board for the first month, and the month that you get free, and they all tried it out. Everyone was really excited about it. We had this big guild, and it was really cool. And then the free month ran out, and 90% of the people were like, not so much. Because Dan and I are a little thick, we didn't quite jump on that train soon enough.
Yeah.
So we've been playing it for a few months now.
We were a little hesitant to try something like that again real quick.
Yeah.
But
like I said, we're real thick. So.
Well, but there's a groundswell of interest on the forums for us to start up a guild on the new Warhammer Online game that just came out.
And I found out that I can play Solomon Kane.
So we are going to try setting up a guild on the Thorgrim, that's Thorgrim or something like that, Thorgrim server on the Order side, which is the good guy side. In fact, is already started. There's several of us playing there. I don't have a guild name yet. I'll post it things in the show notes as I get them. But if you're interested in picking up Warhammer Online or already have and are interested in running a character with us, be sure to roll up something on the Order side on the Thorgrim server.
We need plate.
Yeah, well, we need plate and we need people.
Yes.
Because MMOs are really, really freaking boring when you're playing with yourself and one other guy, which is why the Age of Conan one flopped. It sounds like this Warhammer one's actually got some momentum, and we're counting on you to make that true.
If you're thinking about buying it but not sure, I would describe it as World of Warcraft Plus. There's things that it does better than World of Warcraft. There are things that World of Warcraft do the same, which kind of makes them, when you line it all out at the end of the day, they're kind of at the same level of fun and complexity and such. So if you're...
But it's a good, solid game. And I have to say, this is the best launch I've ever seen. I'm playing right now in the pre-release era, and I have yet to run into a single glitch, client crash. And I've never seen that before.
Right.
WoW's release, EverQuest 2, every other game I've ever played at release has been full of problems. This is the smoothest release I have ever seen, which to me, at least, knock on wood, says good things about where it's headed.
Right.
All righty, old man. As you're filling out your will, I'm sure you're having to say who's going to get what. And in the process of that, you're digging into the dun, 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 gamer closet.
Oh, boy.
What crap have you found in there recently?
Get out your rubber gloves and your shovel.
All right, this is like checking Chris's colonoscopy.
That's right. Ooh, corn.
You went there. Yes. I love you, Chris Hussey.
I have been actually finally cleaning, not cleaning out the closet, but rearranging the closet properly. You know,
this is starting to sound like a euphemism.
Yeah.
For 2 years, basically, 90% of all my gaming stuff was boxed up because we had moved from Minnesota. I left my stuff up in Minnesota because our house didn't sell because the housing market blows. But that finally all changed. I was able to bring everything down here, and I set up some college dorm shelves in my basement. And now I'm slowly unraveling everything or unpacking everything out of my various boxes and bins. But what I have in the closet today, honestly, has to probably be one of my favorite game products of all time. They are called Pulp Dungeons, and they were third-party D&D products when third-party D&D products weren't cool or legal.
What's the copyright on that? I know you showed us one on the...
Copyright on these babies comes from around 1996, 1997. So they've got a few years on them. And what these are is they kind of do what Mayfair Games didn't do when they put out some D&D adventures way back when. They basically, there's a number of cool things about them. First of all, they're extremely short because they're just basic dungeon crawls. Two, they're extremely inexpensive, and they make very good point of that right on the cover because they have like a big stamp thing here that says, hey, $395. Wow, $395. Look, $495. They're very, very inexpensive at that time. And this is the time when modules were, you know, running anywhere between $8 and $12.
Now, 1996 to 1997, that's what, second edition D&D?
This would still be second edition, yes.
Were those system specific or were they just generic?
They were very generic, and they did that on purpose. And what they did, they put like a little conversion system in here. They had their kind of their coin cash system in here, basically. And then for damage and wounds and things for creatures, they gave them a certain number of what they called hits, and they would equate one hit equal to the average damage of a sword in your game or the maximum damage from a dagger. So, you know, in D&D terms, roughly about 4 points. And so every monster in here would have a certain number of hits attached to it, and then they would have, you know, they would have kind of like certain checks that you could do and kind of match them up with dice. But these things, literally, they're like half of an 8.5 by 11, so whatever that math is. And really, actually, the only D&D, close D&D reference they have is they attach them to somewhat of a level thing. So like this one I'm looking at here, which is called the Shaman's Totem, it's listed as mid-level adventurers. But they have them for upper-level adventurers, they have from low to mid-level adventurers, for high-level adventurers, so on and so forth. And as we've talked about before, about cover art, getting people to look at stuff, what they did, I learned, was they took some Braum artwork or other well-known artist artwork, and they would basically like re-license all this old artwork. So the cost of putting cool art on the cover was very, very low. And so you got some attractive art to make you good to grab it. You got a cheap price to make you think about it even more. And then they kind of put them out in series, so they'd have like a series of three modules that might come out at once or one every other month or something, so to keep you buying them.
Did you ever actually subject anyone to these?
Oh yeah, many times. I equate
you
these.
Bastard.
But not all of them. There was the initial series that came out. There was a couple ones in here, the Forsaken Elves, and the An Infestation of Kobolds, which are related. They're in the same series.
You need some penicillin for that.
Back in Chris's day, they had to game pulp dungeons uphill both ways.
That's right.
They couldn't afford real official dungeons. They had to get the generic dungeons with the white labels and black lettering.
You know what's
them.
Funny, though? I guess not funny, but just interesting. You know, funny, but not ha-ha funny.
Like smelly bad funny?
All right. No, I was going for Sling Blade reference there, which would be, anyways. But what's kind of interesting about that is that market has not at all disappeared or died. It's just become...
Just gone online?
Well, it's more than gone online. It's just become... It's codified. Because back in that day, I really, really doubt that TSR was licensing anyone to make products like that.
And they were not. In fact, they went after Mayfair Games when they did it early in the day. But go ahead.
But now you have the exact same sort of thing going on through the OGL with the 3.0 and 3.5 rules and the tons and tons and tons of companies mm-hmm. that are out there putting out tons and tons and tons of material that is just these little quick adventures or setting guides that you can plug right into the existing game system. So I think it's interesting to, in my mind at least, this kind of product, and I'm not going to claim they were the first, I mean, being in 1996... This
right.
kind of product, though, is sort of a, you can see how it sets up where we are today.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. They're very cool. And I equate them to being the gamer equivalent of flour. You know, I mean, this it's your base ingredient that you can add stuff to make whatever you want. Because really, I mean, each one, even though it is a dungeon crawl, there is a small story laid out in there. There's a little tiny plot that you can easily build off, and of course, as with most third-party things, you can plug in to anywhere you want to go. So,
you know,
I mean, in that sense, they worked really good.
I think there was a time back somewhere in my gaming life when I would have been interested in products like that, simply because we've gotten to the point now where we are, quite frankly, so snobbish that we would rather not game at all than have a mediocre game if we knew that going into it. But there was a time when, you know, we didn't take gaming quite so psychotically seriously.
I don't know. I still don't take gaming as seriously as all that. I mean, I do want to have a serious game and a fun game, but I'm also hanging with my buds.
Yeah,
too,
and I guess, okay, maybe I'm overstating the point then. But I definitely could have seen a time where it's like, well, we don't really have a plot written for tonight, but we've got our characters, we want to do something.
And we've got a whole lot of beer.
And
the generic creamed corn, and the generic dungeon.
Yeah, and we've got our $3.95 anus of the shaman or whatever the...
What a horrible talisman to wear around your neck. The anus of the shaman.
All right, come on.
Is that like a Vecna thing?
I was going to say.
That's hideous.
There's a gaming nerd joke that I think...
Vecna's leather Cheerio.
I think we have avoided for... all, you know, probably if you throw in bonuses and such, 130, 140 episodes of this show, which is what happened to the other body parts of Vecna.
Yes.
I mean, it's the nerd joke that is made at every D&D table on the face of the earth.
No, we don't do Vecna here. Sorry. The anus of the shaman.
Who's Vecna?
Vecna.
I'm kidding. Okay, I'm kidding.
I say, if you've never wondered happened to the schlong of Vecna,
if I didn't know what Vecna was. No, I would say one thing I wanted to mention was that I think that these small one shot, the pulp type games would even be good for like what you guys have just done. You're talking about getting a new player involved in something. It's just because it's something that's small, short, and sort of relatively easy.
That's also true because it's not just easy to plug in. It's easy to remove. Yeah. It's so generic that you can take a new player, throw them in, teach them the concepts, and if everything goes horribly awry, or they realize by the end of it that they can't stand a particular character class or don't like a particular style of game, it's not like you have to throw out copious amounts of campaign notes. You know what? The adventure is over.
Yep.
Just roll something else up. And so that disposability, it'd also be great for strangers, con games, things like that.
Excellent stuff for one shots.
Yeah, that's actually something I was thinking about back at Gen Con, because they had that game with the podcasters thing, which I ended up skipping out on to go to the White Wolf party. But yeah, seriously, though, for conventions like that, I really ought to have on me like a 3 or 4 page adventure with some generic characters that I could just throw down on the spot and run.
Wait, you're talking about walking around with a whole D&D adventure on you with characters and everything that you just run at any time.
Sure.
That is a whole new level of nerd right there.
I'm talking in a
gaming convention here.
And we know that you'd have the emergency gaming fanny pack.
Yeah. Oh, all right.
Hey, man, you back off. I used to wear a fanny pack. I refuse to use the term fanny pack, and I wore a hip pack. And actually, I'll tell you a very funny non-gaming related story to that. Mm-hmm. I wore it one time in a commercial spot, and somebody made the comment to me after seeing that, says it looks like I was wearing a colostomy bag, and then I stopped wearing it at that point.
It's your man bag. Wow. It's your man purse.
And now you're getting to the age, it will be a colostomy bag.
Actually, now at 40, you're not supposed to wear it because it's bad for your back. So, you know, those days are behind.
What, colostomy bags?
No, just the man bag.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Colostomy bags throwing out your back. You got some serious dietary issues.
Too much fiber.
All righty. Last of the GM profiles. I guess so. In the future, as we change out and bring on new hosts, maybe we'll subject them to this as well.
Sure.
But of the current circulation of hosts, the last of the GM profiles, which is me. And
boring. Moving on.
So our main topic for today.
Yeah. Spaceship combat.
No, my topic. The way that I run a game is obviously on the far side of how Chad runs the game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I enjoy things like rules. And preparation. Yes. And
if you enjoy preparation H.
Aren't we supposed to grill you with questions?
Didn't see that one coming.
Well, all right, let me at least set this up. In fact, I'm probably going to.
Now,
do your opening statement, Mr. Redinger.
Being the master debater that I am, I can anticipate many of your questions, but I'll.
Yeah. So just for the audience before we, you know, we're completely derailing this anyway, and everyone's like, shut up and let him talk. Your style and my style, all jokes aside, is totally polar opposites from each other. But I have been in your games, and you have been in my games, and I've been in far more your games, and I enjoy your style. Do you enjoy my style?
Yes, and I have enjoyed your style.
Okay.
You know, I would look at this the same way that I can enjoy fiction and nonfiction books,
mm-hmm.
or I can enjoy both action and dramatic movies, or I can enjoy RPG video games and flight sims. You know, mm-hmm. it's the same kind of thing. Is the gaming experience different? Oh, yes, absolutely so.
Mm-hmm.
Because in your game, there is a lot of emphasis put on the energy level and proactivity and motivation of the players.
Yeah, I really like to focus on
and
the individual.
That's not to say in my game it doesn't matter. In my game, I hate the railroad cinematic, you're along for the ride plots. Right. I despise those. But let's use my Shades of Gray thing I haven't used probably in 100 episodes. But, you know, there's a shade of gray there where you need less of that in my game right. than you would in yours.
And your games focus on the large and big, yes. and mine focus way down into the individual.
I'm going to start with the two questions we've been asking everyone else, which is, before I explain my style, what is my greatest strength and greatest weakness? The greatest strength that I have as a game master, and this is not just something that I believe myself, but I've gotten as consistent feedback over the years, is my ability to write plots. That I can write plots that are intricate. They will never utterly confuse you. You'll never feel lost. You'll always know where you need to go, but they will always keep you guessing. There's going to be layers of stuff going on, but I can deliver it in a way where it's not J.J. Abrams.
You know,
it makes sense.
You know what's funny is that I'm the only person sitting here, only person listening to this, who you say this and it's just like, that's not true. And the only reason I say that is because we gamed when we were teenagers.
Yes.
And it was like, you learn. I mean, the Absolutely. Whole thing, you learned and you grew, but it's like, oh my God, the first thing, my plots aren't confusing. Oh my God, I remember this Forgotten Realms game with this piece of wood, and it was like, what is going on? And then you lost track of your own plot. But like I said, Absolutely. We were teenagers.
Right. So I say, if I had someone here who had gamed with me more recently, someone mm-hmm. like Mike,
sure.
You know, he would absolutely back this up. I know that because he's said this to me himself right. many times. Now, my greatest weakness as a GM and the greatest thing that I struggle with is the same thing that I have struggled with all the way back to the start of my gaming career, which is not going overboard, where mm-hmm. I don't try to spend so much time planning that I discourage myself and never get the plot written, mm-hmm. or I actually pull it off and I come to the game with 3 inches of paper. And that yeah. right there, that is my greatest weakness.
You're trying to write a game, not a book.
All right.
So, Dan, all of this aside, everybody's chomping at the bit. What's your gaming style?
All righty. This is Dan talking, so this is going to be in a numbered list.
Oh,
I'm going to give you the 5 steps.
To being more like Dan.
The 5 steps.
Step 1.
Of how I write the game. Step 2, got a hole in the box.
Step 3,
have Carl open the box.
Get the players to open the box.
Step 4, have Chris open the box.
Whoa!
Step 5, pour in hot nachos.
Yeah!
I do like nachos. Alrighty, so the first thing I try to do is I come up with a general concept for the game. Just vaguely, what is it that I want to do? I want to tell the story of a BattleTech mercenary organization from its start to its finish. And mm-hmm. I want it to be epic, and I want it to be involved in all kinds of politics and intrigue. And just, I come up with a quick concept of the sort of the game that I want to run.
Now, wait, related to that, though, do you start at the beginning, or do you start at the end, or do you start somewhere in the middle?
I generally tend to start in the middle. For the simple reason, I'll tell you right now, and actually maybe I would change what my greatest weakness is. The biggest thing I struggle with, especially if I'm given weak character backgrounds to work with, is starting the game. That I know how I want the middle to go. And once you reach the middle, this game will have so much momentum, you will have no trouble reaching the end. It may not be the end I expected, but that's fine. I can roll with that. This is not a railroad. But I do not have any problem getting to that end. So I typically write from the middle. I picture something that I want this to generally be about, even if I don't know how we're going to get there or how we're going to resolve the issue. Step 2 is I come up with a master plot arc. Okay, we're going to do the BattleTech thing, so maybe I'll write down just some bullet points. I'm not going to fill up a ton of paper, you know, one page top, where I'm just going to say, here's what's going on behind the scenes. They're going to form a mercenary corps. It's going to turn out that the financial guy that's helping them form it is actually going to get bought off by House Marek, and he's going to come back after them later and screw them. And there's these two dukes from various planets that are going to try and convince them to work for one or the other and buy them out. And in the end, it's actually all over some hidden cache of technology that nobody knows about. And so I write this general plot arc of here's what's going on behind the scenes. It's actually kind of similar to what John described, where he said that he writes out this is what will happen if the bad guy has his way and lets the players diverge from there. I don't quite write it that way, but it's in that same sort of vein. Step three, I figure out my major NPCs. I like to be consistent. And so what I'll do is I'll take maybe an Excel spreadsheet. Once again, keep it short. I've got to fight myself to not go overboard. But I'll take the major NPCs they're going to see on a regular basis, both good guys and bad guys. Give them a name, one or two sentences of physical description, a few nouns and adjectives that remind me of what their personality archetype is like. I don't get too complex because I won't be able to remember or recall that information fast enough to roleplay it.
Okay, and related to that, though, when you have your brief notes on your major NPCs, as the campaign progresses and they start running into these NPCs, do you then update your notes to, you know, reflect various changes in the personality or interactions or things like that so that you know what you're doing then when you re-reference them?
Yes, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why I don't do it on a laptop, other than I don't like hiding behind a screen while I'm GMing. But I don't do it on a laptop because when I print off the NPC sheets, I will typically leave a little bit of extra space next to each of the guys. And I also might grid off some empty rows. So if in the middle of it, all of a sudden they take a really unexpected interest in this one shopkeeper over here, I can suddenly pencil in his name, his description, his personality, and a quick note of where he's at. But yes, I will absolutely sit there with pen or pencil marking up this sheet all over the place as the game goes on. Steps 4 and 5 are very closely related. The only thing that's different is step 4 is a step that I only do once, but I will typically do it the same time I do step 5. What I do with step 4, because I have trouble starting the game, and because I think most gaming groups, including the players, have trouble starting the first game, getting everyone into the action, getting everyone in character, getting everyone going with the flow, I will fairly heavily script the first maybe hour of the gameplay. I will write quick blocks of dialogue. I'll have little interactions. I will do everything I can to draw everyone into the environment. I'll have, you know, I had a Forgotten Realms game, which I may yet run again, and there's a guy in there who's a priest of the god of luck. And so I'll write a quick little scene where if anyone walks past the gate, he will waylay them, insist on reading their fortune, and then tell them nothing about what he saw. Just because it gets them suddenly, you know, gets them thinking right about their characters and involved in the action. But I will script one point at a time, exactly what's going to happen. So-and-so's over here and they get called into the Baron's quarters and this happens and that happens, but only for about that first hour, just to make sure we're on the right track. And that leads me to step 5, which is what I will do from that point, hour 2, all the way through the end of the very last game at the very end of the campaign, which is I will only write very general, high-level, bullet point type notes of, they might run into a guy in this bar who happens to work for the Duke, and it's possible they could coerce him into saying something. Or if the action gets a little too slow, this guy might pull out a gun. Or if they come to this island, here's some of the things they might learn if they ask around with the right people. Just these high-level conceptual notes that are written almost like Legos, so that I've got all the material I need, but I can mix and match and rearrange as I need to. And if they decide they're not going to go to that island, well, I can just on the fly try to figure out, okay, well, here's the facts they needed to learn. You know what? They'll run into a guy over here on this place that will tell them the exact same thing anyway.
Do you make a lot of use, I mean, aside from your intro, then, so what you're saying is you don't make a lot of use of the quote-unquote box text, you know, to kind of like, you know, mood set or give, you know, more detailed description of what characters are encountering as they enter into areas?
I will sometimes, but only if, and this goes back to the detailed plot thing, only if I have to be extremely careful about how I convey something. If somebody's going to say something in a way that is kind of ambiguous and could imply a couple different things, but I don't want to give away too much, I might write that out verbatim. But most of the time, no. And this goes back to something that I have talked about in previous episodes, which is one of the things I do with my NPCs, and I also do this with my settings, is I try to avoid using outright stereotypes because they're boring, but I try to use archetypes because they're easy to recall. So let's say as I'm just kind of sitting there at home twiddling my thumbs or watching TV or whatever, I see the inside of a space station. And that really kind of just grabs my fancy. And I'll kind of tuck that away somewhere to where I can just write a couple quick notes on what a space station looks like, but I could still give a really big detailed explanation of what this place looks like, what they're seeing, where they are. When I went on an actual cruise on an oceanic vessel, I have memorized certain things about that ship that I use for spacefaring cruise lines in my sci-fi games. And I try to do it that way so it's real easy for me to recall, so I don't get lost in my notes. Because one of the worst things you can do if you're my style of GM is get lost in your own notes, where you're reading, which is boring, or you're trying,
searching, which is also boring. So you describe yourself as pretty note heavy, though.
As far as this group goes, yes. Yeah. I'm a far cry from where I used to be.
Yes.
I will come to a game typically with no more than maybe 3 to 6 pages total. And a lot of those are going to be big, heavy, spaced out things with like, well, here's 12 NPCs that I may only need one this game or something like that. But yes, I'm notes heavy as far as this group goes.
I know you do this a lot, but obviously people can't read my mind. How much do you recycle your own material?
A lot, for two reasons. One, because my gaming groups have changed so much. Because I have had so many people come and go from my gaming groups that I find I can reuse a lot of the plots, particularly the ones that worked before. Mm-hmm. You know, ditch the flops, take the ones that worked before, and bring them in again. The second reason, I guess there's actually three reasons, but the second reason is because I can mature them. I ran something all the way back in junior high, and it was a childish game. Mm-hmm. But I have since then figured out how to take those basic concepts and make them nuanced and compelling and deep.
It's a good thing you're a pack rat, too.
Honestly, yes. I have notes going all the way back, I mean, 20 years. But the third thing is also, with the different groups of people, they're going to play the plots out in different ways. Mm-hmm. I could name specific campaigns. One of which being that Forgotten Realms campaign you mentioned with the piece of wood, which I have refined and perfected since then, that I have run now 2 or 3 different times, and everyone has gone through it a different way, even though it's the exact same plot line. Mm-hmm. They've ended up with radically different conclusions, and I would love to see how our current Sunday group would handle it. You guys have asked me to run Star Trek instead
of Forgotten. Play another fantasy game, I'm going to stab myself in the eyeballs with a spoon.
And I can't
blame you. Are we going to find some floating space wood? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes.
That's awesome.
I hate to tell you this, Pat. Space Dan put some sort of wood and hit all of his games.
I can't remember if that would be Flotsam or Jetsam, but you are damn well going to find it. So.
Well, along those lines, whenever you do recycle these things, how have you found that it played off in subsequent tellings of this recycled material? And by that, I mean, have you always found that it's been successful, or sometimes those ones that worked before, they've flopped, you know, in the second or third time or what? Have they done well?
They've generally been very successful.
Cool. That's good.
Typically when they flop, it flops because either usual game crap, we get distracted, the group's not taking the game seriously, whatever. Mm-hmm. Or because I tried to run a new group through it the exact same way I did the previous group, and I didn't adjust for the fact that they're different people with different motivations and different interactions, and that kills it.
Sure.
But when I actually get myself together and do it right, and the group is on board and with me, almost without fail, it goes wonderfully.
That's cool. Because from what you just said, I think it could be difficult just for that very reason. Like what you said is that you played through it once before and this is how it was done and that's how you remember it. And then you've got, like you said, a whole new group of people with whole new ideas, you know, and that just would be
pooping
challenging
on your campaign.
Yeah, I can see that as a challenge. So that's, I think that's an interesting thing to do to, you know, as a challenge for a game master, is to pull in that stuff that you've done before and be able to successfully pull it off again.
How do you deal, Dan, when people go essentially off your notes? I mean, when they go
off
so far
rails
out of what you when they go off the notes that you have made, you know, are you able to essentially go noteless? Are you able to go, Chad?
Well,
wow.
Once you go, Chad,
you never go back. Yes and no.
Once you go, Chad, you always go glad.
Yes and no. No, for the simple reason that because the plots are as complex as they are, I don't find that I can completely improv for too long, because I may be digging myself into a hole where I'm wrecking intended parts of the plot as I just try to fill. That I have somebody do something that absolutely contradicts where that was supposed to be going or something
else.
That's
when it gets fun.
Well, but having said that, there's a reason why earlier I talked about my notes intentionally being written and these rough concepts that are something like Legos, where if they go off the rails, that's not too big of a deal. My notes are written where, okay, I thought they were going to go to space station A. Instead, they landed on planet B. No big deal. They just need to figure this stuff out.
Now they're in colony C, which looks a lot like space station A.
That, or even if it's radically different, even if in my mind, I've already said that's a warlike society and these are a bunch of pacifists and I can't make it be the same place. Then I just think it through for a minute and say, look, here's what had to come out of that plot point. You know, it's not like you have to talk to this person, that person, that person. The point is you have to learn these things and accomplish these things. On the fly, I just have to have the creativity to reinvent the way those things are going to occur.
You and I sound similar in the sense of the level of notes, and you, although it seems like you use a lot less descriptive text than I do, what do you, you know? I know that this would not be a problem for Chad at all because of the way his style is, but when it comes to veteran players sniffing out either something that matters in what you're talking about or something that doesn't matter in what you're talking about, how do you walk that line to keep them, to always keep those veteran players guessing? Because that is a difficult thing to do.
Never been an issue for me, at least not in recent years, for a simple reason of the way my plots are. Because my plots are, I guess the best way I could describe them is multilinear. There are many things that matter in different ways. That, for example, if they sniff out something that they think is important, they're probably right. But they may not understand why it's important or how it's important. Or in the process of chasing that, they may be ignoring something else that's equally important. I would compare it sort of like we were talking about Fallout actually off mice. And I would compare it something to like that sort of a game where you have a consistent starting point and there's a general overarching plot you can't escape. But whether you want to go to City A or City B, or you want to pick up NPC A or NPC B, that's really not going to change my plot. It just is going to change what you get out of the plot. I've run campaigns where, and I know I've mentioned this in the past, people have befriended guys that were supposed to be the ultimate bad guy. And so that's not a problem because there's so much other stuff going on that all I have to do is kind of figure out, okay, they've moved over to this part of the plot, but these other guys are still going on with their plans that may be just as questionable.
I just want to say one thing before we move on. And it's about your step four. I like your step four, and I'm looking forward to seeing how that goes in our next game that we play with our group. The Star Trek game. Since this will be the fourth different campaign that we've played in this group of players now, I think you're right. We have that trouble getting started, and I'll be anxious to see how this.
I'll be anxious to see if it works.
Well, that's what I mean. If it'll work with our group, if anything can help our poor group. But, to see how that works, I think it sounds really, really like a good idea. And I think that is something that you need to do, like you said, just to get the ball rolling in that first hour or so to get those characters to sort of gel in a group sort of a way and mm-hmm. get things going. So
on a more important note, I did go out and buy a new Type 1 phaser and Type 2 phaser prop. Awesome. Because I got so freaking tired of constantly trying to explain the difference between a Type 1 and Type 2 phaser. So, call for your GM profiles. This is the last one we're going to make. If you want to send in a GM profile, keep it down to about 5 minutes or less. Send it ideally in an MP3 format to feartheboot@gmail.com. If you just have to do a wave or something weird like that, then send us a link because I don't know that I really want to deal with like a 500 meg file. What we're going to do with those is we're going to pick what we think are some of the better ones and compile them into an hour or so bonus mm-hmm. episode that we will drop. And it's going to take us a couple
we're
weeks.
We're going to pick. We have more than an hour's worth of submissions.
Last I checked, we're headed that direction. We may not. If we don't, then we'll use what we have. But we looked like we were headed that way. And we are going to put these up. And this is going to take us a couple weeks, so we're going to have a lot of material to work through, and plus I need to clear out some deadlines with my job right now. So give us a little bit on this, but we're going to put those together and drop it out. Then what we are going to let you do, Chad has just been gracious enough to inform us that he has a $25 gift certificate to iTunes that he has managed to procure through his channels.
Indeed. My nefarious dark minions procured it for me.
What we are going to do is, once we get all this stuff together, we're going to call up the folks from the Ennies. I mean, we're going to...
Zing.
What we're going to do is we're going to put up some kind of a voting mechanism, either on the website or more likely on the forums, where you guys can go and vote for your favorite GM profile. And the winner of that little contest will get a $25 gift certificate to iTunes, as well as we'll probably let them pick something out of the Fear the Boot store, and we'll send them a t-shirt or mug or whatever it is that they would like. And if you're going to send these in, try to get these in, let's say, within 2 weeks tops of this episode dropping. And then we'll take 2 or 3 weeks after that to put them together, and we'll get this drop sometime, probably quarter four of 2008.
Mm-hmm.
Last thing we're going to talk about today is something that actually kind of ties into or wraps up the series we've been doing.
It's kind of the cap of it, not the whole point, but just the sort of parting shot for the series.
Because we talked about in episode 114, trying to get new folks in the hobby, explain the hobby to them. In 115, chapters 1 through 7, we talked directly to them and trying to help them understand the hobby. Now we want to come back and talk to you guys again, assuming you've actually managed to land some suckers that are going to try this hobby out. How do you, as a game master or as a fellow player, and we'll attack this from both directions,
if we have time.
Well, if we have time, and if not, maybe we'll slow this.
Someone was Mr. Babel on his GM profile.
Well, you know what, though? We were a little bit late with getting things together on 115. So if we run a little long, we'll just consider this a freebie to everyone out there who has a longer than 1 hour commute. Poor bastards.
Yeah, really.
But what we want to talk about is how you can help ease a new player into the role-playing game experience.
Lots of lube.
Make them do everything.
The first thing, and this is definitely more of a GM than a player thing, but it could be a player thing as well, is you have to understand that this is someone who probably feels uncertain of themselves. Even if they're boisterous and outgoing and extroverted, and they don't seem shy or uncertain, they are still a fish out of water at this point in time. Go easy on them.
Mm-hmm.
Don't bury them in rules. Don't, and this is probably the bigger one, don't make their actions have too many consequences. If they say something to so-and-so that would get them killed on the spot and everyone knows it, they probably don't.
Yeah.
And so have the guy, you know, teach him a lesson, have the guy chew him out and yell at him, and the guards nearly kill him, but at last minute he calls them off and says, no, you know, he's just a fool who knows no better. Don't be afraid to use what we call the magic rewind of, hey, you know, Bob, what you just said, that's a bad idea for this reason. Try that again, and this time don't call him that, and let's start right from where you were.
Yeah. And you have to be careful how you frame it. You don't say, Bob, let's rewind that and don't F it up this time.
Yeah.
You know, let's try to avoid that level of harshness for the new guy. You know, in War Machine, at least in the St. Louis area, I don't know if anybody else does this, we kind of have this sort of spoken rule about introducing a new player to the game. You throw the first game. And not only do you just throw it, I mean, you don't want to be obvious about it and to have all your guys run forward and then turn around with your backs to them or whatever, but what you do is, you know, you kind of play the game out, you give them a little tactical advantages, and you're talking to them, you're helping them out as you're doing it. But in War Machine, you have a feat, which is your one-time, one-shot, big kaboom that you can do once per game. And you don't teach them about the feat at the beginning. You play the game, and then you set yourself up for them to use their feat on you and kill you.
Right.
And that's the same way, and not so much in a role-playing game where it not so much the combat and tactical aspect of it, but more in the, you know, maybe this one game in his first game, he could kind of be the hero, you know, maybe you don't focus all the spotlight on, but in some way, it's like, there's the red button to stop the self-destruct of the space station you're on, set up so he's the guy who presses it.
Absolutely.
You know, that sort of thing. In the first game.
There's definitely a lot to be said for, you know, the whole, you know, let the Wookiee win just even a little bit. You know, let them come away with some success. Yeah, even if it's something small or major, you know, whether it's a decisive victory in a combat or just a lucky roll and getting to kill two guys while everyone else got one, you know, that kind of thing.
Combat right along those lines.
Well, and real quick, whatever you do, don't tell them that you threw the game, you know? That's the main, because that steals the thunder.
Yeah, I mean, don't tell them you threw the game, but depending on the person, it may be helpful to say, hey, don't be too worried, we're going to go easy on you.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't want to make it too obvious, because, yeah, you don't want to make them feel like you're just condescending to them the whole time. You know, I think one simple rule that I could use that would sum this entire thing up is pretend it's you. We've all been that guy. Yeah, we've all been the guy who's the first time in the hobby, just started a new job, just picked up a new TV series, and everybody knows what's going on but you.
Right.
Or at least you feel that way. Think about what that felt like. Think about how you would want to be treated in those circumstances and extend them the same courtesy. If you have to, you know, don't quite condescend, but over-explain. Keep pausing. Do you follow what's going on? Mm-hmm. Do you understand what this stat means on your character? Hey, the game master just said this. And by the way, you don't have to do this, but your character has a power that you could use right here that would cause this. Do you want to do that? You know, and you know, do some things to kind of help them along and really keep them involved the same way you would want someone to reach out to you if you were lost.
I remember, on the game master side of the screen, related to that, don't have them go first. You know, when you as a GM shine that spotlight, you know, shine it on a veteran player first, if it's possible, and give that new player a chance to see exactly how that one-on-one interaction goes, and then give them that chance to do the same thing. You know, and also if it's possible, don't have essentially that player out on their own with their character in a spot by themselves where they don't have that support of another player who might be going in the middle. If the party splits, you know, you want to give them the spotlight, but you got to make sure they have some support behind there just in case, for the very reasons that you mentioned.
I remember my first game, and I've talked about it way, way in the early episodes, where I was that teenage spaz that you don't ever want at your games. And I don't blame, again, I played with some family members, and I don't blame them for never, ever inviting me back again. I would not want me in the game. But to flip the coin a little bit, to tell the other side of that story, there were things that they should have done a little bit better. They should have gone to the future and listened to Fear the Boot, but yes. You know, you can't have everything.
We'd all be better people for that.
Well, we played the Ravenloft module before it was a campaign setting. Oh, we were playing through the it was your basic kill the vampire, sort of
crush the crystal heart,
dungeon sort of thing, and I just had no clue what was going on. I didn't know the rules, but that was another thing. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't understand why we were there, what we were doing there. I had no, and they were already in the middle of going through this thing. And it's just like, I felt too embarrassed to ask. So I guess if you're starting a campaign, it's a little different. Just make sure that all your players know what's going on going into it when you do that. But if you bring somebody in the middle of the campaign, you know, one of the ways not to overwhelm them and drive them away is to make sure they know what the hell is going on. Just don't start the game from where you left off. Sit down with them and say, this is what the story is. This is what the plot is. This is what the characters are doing.
But there's a balance there. You're 100% right.
I am.
But there's a balance there.
What you say?
Of conversely, you can overwhelm the person.
Yes, yes.
You can make the person, you can bury them in so many proper nouns and events and dates and places and things that they are going to feel worse than when they started. And so you've really got to keep it down. And
to the cliff notes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Keep it down to the cliff notes. Tell them what they need to understand what's going on. Let them digest it slowly. And then explain things as the game goes on. We're going to go here. Hey, by the way, Bob, were you aware that actually when this place is like this and they know a little something about that, and your character, you know, since you're from here, you might think this of these people over here. So they don't need to know it all before the game starts.
When I was introduced to the current group that we have, and this was a little bit before Dan joined us with Ein Hadar Har Eat Har Har and Salty Dog and you, Pat, you know, I was introduced in the middle of a campaign. That had actually, it was like the second part. You guys had already done something with it before, something like that. maybe you weren't part of it yet, Pat. Anyway, it was neat because every time we would go to a new major location, they would stop, and it was a very beer and pretzel sort of game, and they would say, oh, and this is what our characters did here before, and this is why we're known here, and here's a, you know, here's a gaming story. You know, here's what we did, and here's the rollicking adventures we had in this sort of floating tavern and the steampunk sort of Zeppelin and airship campaign, and it was like that. And when we would, in our airship, we would travel across the lands, and it's like, oh, well, now we're traveling over these lands, and we can't land here because, you know, so-and-so did this, and that was crazy, and this, and it was neat. As we were playing through the game, they were telling me the story. Now, of course, the game went really, really slow because of that, but it made me feel welcome.
Right. I think a lot of it's reading the person, because as I sit here and listen to the advice we're giving, you know, it's such a razor's edge of you want to make sure they know what's going on, but you don't want to overwhelm them. You want to make sure they get some attention, spotlight, and they're the hero. But once again, you don't want to overwhelm them or put them on the spot. You want to make them do the big things and have the big wins, but you don't want to make it obvious or, in truth, throw the game for them. And so I think a lot of this is really you just got to know the person and feel the situation out. I mean, be able to read them. And if you can't read them, that's fine. Ask them. Say, hey, you know, do you feel like you understand what's going on? Are you having a good time? Do you get what's happening here? Reassure them. Hey, the first time I role played, I was really lost. Or when
I pooped my pants.
When I joined this group, they were mid campaign. I had no idea what was going on. All you got to do is just take it easy, relax. Two games from now, you'll have it all figured out, or enough of it figured out, and you'll be just fine. Just be patient and stick with it.
What do you guys think about in-character type stuff? Like, you have the new guy who's never played a role-playing game before, and let's say you're playing D&D, and you have all veteran players, and say so-and-so is playing a wizard, make the new guys the wizard's apprentice. Do you think that's a good idea or a bad idea? I guess it depends on the people, but generally speaking.
It depends, but honestly, I would say that's a bad idea, because I think that you're initially keying them into, you know, quote-unquote subservient role. And, you know, again, if you don't necessarily know how they're going to develop and mature as a player, they might always kind of fall into that pattern. I mean, yeah, it'd be a great storyline if this apprentice then grew and eventually, you know, the teacher becomes a master kind of situation where he could end up challenging the other player. But you don't know if they're gonna be able to do / handle that or not. You know, so I don't know if I would do that.
Well, I think there's also a bigger risk there of not just a subservient role, but that you become a character accessory. That you are always just whatever you're doing was whatever he's doing. But I do think Chad's onto a great idea though, which is tying the person in. That maybe you're not the wizard's apprentice, but you might be the wizard's brother.
Right.
And so now all of a sudden there's somebody in the game that you're tied to that's going to watch out for you, that you immediately feel that kind of camaraderie with.
And don't get real, real deep with the role playing where the new player is my brother, but our parents were killed and I blame him. And there's all this angst and deep. It's just like, OK, come on. It's his first time. Let's not do the Shakespeare quite yet.
He's just my brother. Yeah, because he's my brother, we love each other, we get along, and I'm going to watch out for him.
Right.
So now I have an excuse to give him advice both in-game and out-of-game. And you know what? Write that into the character if it helps. He's from out of town.
Yeah.
He's from a faraway land where they don't know your customs, and it fits right in. I tell you, though, something along those lines that you've got to watch out for as well with role-playing is, I mean, let's call this for what it is. You're taking someone, bringing them to a group of what may be totally or at least mostly strangers, and asking them to play make-believe and speak it aloud.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people that are going to feel either very uncertain or very uncomfortable with that at first. And this is a place where, and maybe this is true of a lot of the stuff we're talking about here, you can give them some advice, you can give them some coaching, but more than anything else, lead by example. It's human nature that we tend to adapt to the environments we're in. We pretty quickly learn how to fit in, you know, things you can say and not say and the way you should do things. And the best thing that you can do as you're riding that razor's edge of helping the person without overwhelming them, the biggest thing you can do where you can never go wrong is set a good example.
Yes.
Role play well, watch out for each other, play nice with the GM, GM play nice with the players. Mm-hmm. Just conduct a good game where everybody's getting along and everybody's working out. I mean, it may take them a game or two, but they'll fall right into place because they'll just start doing what you're doing.
You got to have patience with them, too, and not that, oh, they're going to F up every single turn. Not that kind of patience, but more, gee, is he enjoying himself? Is he getting into this? It's been two games, and he just kind of sits there and... Give them some, communicate with them. Ask them, hey, is this cool? And if they keep on saying, oh, yeah, I'm having a great time, but they still don't do anything, give them a couple of games to warm up,
because
it is pretty intimidating, especially when you have really rambunctious players who like to role play and get real deep and stuff. You know, and actually, that kind of brings up a second question here. Let's do another scenario. What if you're a game master and you're bringing somebody new in who's never played role playing and is all intimidated and stuff? And you have very, very rowdy in-your-face players. And I'm not talking like high role players. You can have that too. But I mean, they're just like...
I can tell you firsthand how to handle this because I had to deal with this for years with the entire group.
What are you talking about?
And Mike. Because I had, on the one hand, I had you.
What?
I had Neil. I had... text.
What?
I had, I mean,
what are you saying here?
Basically everyone straight down the line.
Mm-hmm.
And then Mike.
Yes.
And you guys were all, we didn't roll initiative. It was whoever was the first to yell something the loudest and it was coherent enough that I could understand it. That was the person who went. And I'm not joking. That's how the games were conducted. And
I have a loud voice that I know how to project and carries well. And it was a competition for me to get initiative.
Yes, it was. Typically, it came down to Chad or Neil. But that was how we did initiative. The idea of having an organized round of, okay, stop. What are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing? That came later. And I'm not talking about combat. I'm talking about RP moments where it's like, you guys walk into a lounge. Chad, what do you do? Pat, what do you do? Mm-hmm. Chris, what do you do? Because of that issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you, there are things.
And this was our teenage years.
Right.
Too.
But the question.
Lots of testosterone and yelling.
But my point being, though, that I still think I have some from experience, some relevant tips.
Sure. Definitely.
One of which is you have to be sure to keep encouraging the quiet person to speak up a little and to be patient as you try to bring the group under control. The second thing I would say is talk to the group.
Yeah.
Say, guys, look, I understand you're excited.
Kind of do the, whoa, shut the hell up.
And even before
Joe, new guy, what do you do?
Even before the game, say, guys, look, this guy's new. He's not going to know what to do. Settle down. Give him a chance to speak. And then third thing is that. It's the tactic we ended up coming up with, where we don't per se do initiative out of combat, but we do have turns, where if they walk in someplace, I don't just say, what do you guys do? And let the screaming commence. I will just pick a person. I'll turn to a person either on my left or on my right, just however the wind blows, and be like, okay, what are you doing? Well, I'm going to go and I want to see what I can find out about this code we just got. I'm going to go ask around. And it may be somewhere in there, you know, Chad will say, you know what? Mm-hmm. That sounds like a great idea, Chris. I'm going to go with you. Pat, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
Bob, quiet guy. Here's what these guys are doing. I give them some options. Here's what these guys are doing. You also notice these other things that are around the lounge that they're just not even bothering with. What do you want to do? But I make sure that I stop and shut everyone else up and everyone goes in turn and this person gets a chance to talk. I mean, it's sad to say, but in many ways, it is the exact same kind of cat herding skills that someone needs to run a functional nursery or grade school of just taking people with that much pixie stick, or in this case, alcohol-soaked energy, and trying to bring them into some kind of a reasonable, sensible order.
And like you said, you know, people tend to reflect their environment. So, I mean, if you have the alcohol-fueled, rowdy group, and then you have the quiet guy, give him some time. You'll break him in. If you just let him go and be quiet and never, you never do anything with him because he is the quiet guy, then he will always be the quiet guy.
Yes.
You know, you've got to bring him forward.
Yes.
And then once you bring him forward, then he'll start getting into the groove and he'll be just another alcohol soaked moron who's screaming at the top.
And you know what?
Not that I would ever do that in a game.
And if you're a player and the GM's not stepping up, you can step up as well.
Yeah.
You can turn to the guy and say, hey, you know what? I'm going to go over here. Do you want to come with me?
Yeah. Or, hey. And then he leans over and goes, well, yeah, but I didn't want to. And then you turn your rowdy on and go, hey, hey, hey.
Yeah.
Bob says he's coming with me.
Or,
you know, what does that mean?
Yeah. Or you say to the GM, hey, can we get some turn orders here? Because I don't think everyone's getting a chance.
Yeah.
Or you say to Bob, hey, you know what? I'm going to go over here. And I don't have a hacking skill, but it just so happens you do, mm-hmm. as if this was a coincidence.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to need you to come over and be the star and help me out. And
but you got
to
yell at Joe, and Joe's the you know, the game master.
Precisely. So
I think that's an important point because I've had plenty of experiences in the past. I think it's important for those veteran players to be to step up to the plate and help with that. And, mm-hmm. and like in my group, in my experiences, that's exactly what we did. I mean, all of our players were good in the fact that they were really helpful to the new character, and they would passively teach them. I say not, mm-hmm. they weren't like telling them, well, you need to do this or whatever, but it would be, you know, talk to them about what they could do or what maybe would be good. Or we would always sort of strategize in this, that, and the other. So mm-hmm. in that part of the session, it would be a good situation where we were looking at everybody's skills as like, okay, well, I'm going to go do this. And, you know, maybe you should go over and do this. And then, oh, okay, then these guys are going to do, you know, whatever else. So I just think it's important to say it's not just the GM. Like you said, it's equally as important to your other players, mm-hmm. especially the veteran players to help out as well. And like I said, I've always had good luck with it. And I think most good cohesive groups are going to be that way if they're not too rambunctious like you guys are talking about. But, you know.
Alrighty then, I guess this is where we're going to go ahead and sign this one out. So as always, thank you guys for tuning in. And don't forget to check out all the various stuff we got going on, the Worldwide Wing Night, the tutorial CD, the Warhammer thing.
Dan, do a shout out for the Warhammer Guild, because that was one thing that people accused us, well, not accused us, but they said last time that we didn't pimp this enough on the show.
We really are. I have managed to get into the Head Start. I've gotten a couple of other people mm-hmm. in as well.
And I'm going
to
be playing as well, yeah.
We are on the Thorgrim server of mm-hmm. Warhammer Online, Age of Reckoning. We really are playing this. We really do hope you guys will come out and join us over on the Order side. We'd love to get another big guild going like what we had on World of Warcraft. Make this a great community resource. So please, if you're at all interested in MMOs or you're picking this game up as it is, please, please, please stop by, check it out, say hi. We'd love to have you over there.
Indeed.
So thank you guys for tuning in, and we will catch you next time.
See ya.
See you next week.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2008, fully owned by its hosts. Our theme song was written and performed by Tim White. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.